Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invite you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Assalamu alaikum. How are you? God Monday morning. Made it another day.
Yes.
Made it through the weekend. Vertical. And moving forward, those are the two checkoff marks. Oh, goodness. So, I do not see our brother Fleming on. And let's do a check-in. Sister? How's your hijab floating?
Hijab is on tight. No problem with the hijab today.
Pardon? It is wonderful. It is the first April.
I think we got a lot of April Fools over there in Washington, D.C.
April, May, June, July, December fools.
I guess I'm starting off on the wrong foot. Let me get into the Ramadan spirit. Okay, all right.
Let's get into the Ramadan spirit because I don't think foolishness knows no any month. Foolishness knows no month. Okay, we're gonna roll it back. Let's say this. Let's start with some news. How's that? Because we got some good things happening in the news. That just it might have your hijab flapping a little bit. I just saw. Remember Ray Nagin, mayor, the former New Orleans mayor, Ray Nagin.
So what about him?
Look how time flies. It was 2014 when he was convicted on federal bribery, money laundering, and other corruption charges. Since we're going to be talking about politics.
Wow.
That was 2014, and he has completed his 10-year federal sentence.
Oh, okay.
It's just...
So they let him out.
It doesn't seem like it was that long ago when he was convicted.
Hmm.
It was just after Hurricane Katrina, when he was convicted, which would bring us back to what happened in Detroit shortly thereafter, that scandal. And so he moved from New Orleans to Texas, and he filed for the right to carry a gun and to restore his voting privileges, so restore his Second Amendment rights and then his voting privileges. And so right now it's this test of whether or not, he filed in New Orleans. He filed his motion in a court motion in New Orleans saying that his federal prison time and his supervision were officially over on March 15th. And he filed without an attorney, and he said he wants his firearm rights restored because he's still a high-profile individual. And he's recognized just about everywhere he goes, and he's concerned about his family's safety in a country where, everybody's experiencing a lot of violence. But there's this attorney at Tulane Law School. He's a professor. He said that he's asking for relief that this particular court doesn't have the right to grant because he doesn't live in New Orleans anymore. He lives in Texas, and a good attorney would have told him that, so he's going to have to file in Texas, right, for that particular right. So it's just an interesting thing, and then he also filed a motion to have his passport returned. He surrendered that during his trial, but as you know, passports expire in 10 years, so the prosecutors aren't really opposing giving him back a passport, which likely expired while he was in prison. So he's going to have to reapply for that anyway. But I just thought this was such an interesting thing that while he was New Orleans mayor during 2002 to 2010, he committed all these bribery, money laundering, fraud, tax violations, and he's coming back now like, okay, I served my time. Now, give me back everything. And he's like, he didn't leave New Orleans, but he's such an interesting, dynamic. Now, the same guy who didn't want to give other people second chances, I'm not saying he shouldn't give it, but, shoes on the other foot. He's 67 now. Hard lesson to learn.
Did it say why he chose to live in Texas? I don't have anything against Texas, but that's interesting.
I know. It's an interesting place to go when you go from New Orleans to Texas, but he didn't say why he chose Texas, but he just knew he couldn't stay in New Orleans. New Orleans was not having him. He couldn't stay in NOLA. They weren't having him anymore.
Okay, so is he under supervision?
He is not. His supervision ended on the 15th of March because he was released from prison in 2020 during COVID, and they granted him supervised release. And so he spent the last four of his 10 years under direct supervision, but that just ended on the 15th. So he finished his 10 years, and he finished the supervision. So, yeah. So that was an interesting one. Yeah. Another small one that's very interesting in the realm of politics is this week in Little Enid, Oklahoma, there is a council member who is, he has ties to white nationalists. I don't like that word, but this is what they're saying. He is facing scrutiny at a recall election. Now, this little community, and it's small, but it only has about 50,000 residents, and it's in the heart of the state, like Wheat Plains. Most of you have heard me say I grew up in the Midwest, Missouri. I have family in Oklahoma. And it's a very, Oklahoma is not very diverse in most areas. But even in the parts where it is diverse, it's not what you would typically understand to be diverse. This particular part in it, is about just under 80% white. It has a large Marshallese, people from the Marshall Islands come there. It's one of three real areas where people from Marshall Islands have settled. And one of the city council members, he was found to, and he admitted it, he admitted to attending the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. He also admitted to attending. Yay. He admitted that he participated in that. He admitted to being part of, connected to the Identity Europa that is defunct now, but it used to be a white supremacist group that it gained notoriety for that particular rally. And he now says that he's opposed to all forms of racial hate and racial discrimination, but he hasn't shied away. But he said in his explanation, I was watching the video, in his explanation he said that before his involvement in the rally and his ties to Identity Europa was that he was trying to bring attention to some of the same issues that got 45 elected in 2016, was that he wanted to secure America's borders. He wanted to reform our legal immigration system. And frankly, he just wanted to push back on anti-white hatred that is really common in media and entertainment. And he got elected, even though it was kind of interesting. He's 75% white, as I said. But one of the pastors there, he said there's a Holy Orthodox Catholic Church there, and that pastor there, he said, I think that a lot of the people in the community, myself included, didn't think he had a chance of winning. And the people who support that ideology, they're very passionate, they're very dedicated. Up until this point, we haven't been. So we just didn't think that he would win. And one of the other council members was like, but this, he won by 26 votes. A 36 vote, over the incumbent, who's also Republican, even though it's a nonpartisan seat, but only 808 of that ward's 5,600 registered voters actually cast ballots. But because he won on his ideology, 808 out of 5,600 of the voters actually cast ballots. And when they found out that he had won, even after the article came in the newspaper, and what the pastor said and what one of the other council members said when they discovered that he had won and now this recall effort is that, they felt really ashamed. And he said, but this has been really galvanizing and helped us get off our butts to fight back. when you have only 14% of the electorate, and not 14% of people who really support this ideology, it really made them think that this is not how we want to be represented. And the reason I wanted to bring this up this morning, as you get started on today's program, is so that people can understand that what we have at stake here on a national scale, and this happens in small towns all throughout the country, this happens in big cities all throughout the country. This last primary election, we had 18% and 26% on the high end of people turning out to vote. But we have in the national poll, they're saying, you know, 80% of people not happy with the way the country is going. 80% of people not happy with the economy. 76% people not happy with student loans or the wages that they earn or how much a carton of eggs cost. But you got 26% of the people voting. You got 18% of the people voting. And in this case, 14.4% of the people voting. So it doesn't matter if you're not going to get up off your hindparts and do something. And this really galvanized this community. So they're focusing right now. I'm not a big fan of recall unless someone has done something egregious. And in this case, I guess participating in a rally where you're saying Jews are not going to replace us is pretty egregious. You know, going through the town with tiki torches, it's pretty egregious, right? And he can come back now and say, you know, I'm no longer part of them. But, sir, you were caught on film. I do believe that you need to vote people out of office. But they say they want to move on to other issues that are important to their community, the homelessness, paying off student lunch debt at their school. You know, if the student can't afford lunch, they're actually indebting the family instead of finding a way to pay to make sure students are fed, which should be a focus in every community. So they're determined to work together in this very small community of 50,000 people. You are, your community is who your core values show you are, and they don't want to be who these 800 people say they are. One small thing can be said about all of our communities all across the country. I wanted to bring it up this morning so that we can take just a lesson from this, all of us. If only 26% of your community voted, and you can find that out by going to your registrar of voters in your area and seeing how many people actually voted in the primary elections, how many people actually voted in the last midterms and then in the last presidential election. And you can see, not only did you vote, but how many people did you affect, help them vote to get out and vote? Because that's what makes the difference. Sitting home and complaining about what we wish could be, I call it Tinkerbell thinking, Disney thinking, there's not going to help us move forward. What's going to help us move forward is moving forward, doing things, action. We are resilient, creative, and innovative as people, and we have to use our access to power to empower our communities to make an impact to move forward. That's todo, madam. And we have a hand. Is that Brother Fleming?
Okay.
I think that might be Brother Fleming. But that's all I wanted to say this morning, madam.
Well, that was a mouthful. And a brain full to make us think. To make us think where the minority in terms of numbers is actually controlling the democracy for the whole local area. Or I think it was the book, that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. I think they were saying 8% of the electorate on the national level generally participates in primary elections. And so, like you said, when you have such a small number of people coming out, then you can't cry about the quality of candidates because you're not putting your voice forward. And I'd like to reflect on this one quote from Imam Muhammad. Excuse me, my allergies are acting up. And he said this in 1992 in Los Angeles. The purpose of the Nation of Islam was to give us enough faith in our own original creation to make us have faith in our ability to think for ourselves, to think independently. I can be a factor for that change because I refuse to give up the practice of thinking for myself. And the reason why I go to that is because it all starts with your mindset. If we just see ourselves as, I'll use this metaphor, if we just see ourselves as renters and not owners, then we act as people who don't have a vested interest in that asset. But if we're the owner, we see ourselves as owners, we see ourselves as worthy of being in charge, worthy of making decisions, worthy of being a part of the leadership, worthy of being a part of setting a course or a direction for our local area, whether it's the school board, whether it is the city council, whether it's the state legislature, whether it's determining who are our congressional and senatorial elected officials and who gets the seat in the White House. So it all starts with mindset. We have to become those independent thinkers that are thinking and acting, actively engaged for our best interests. I'll just remind our audience, for those who may not have heard the broadcast, when we, several months ago, it might even have been a year ago now, when you invited Sister Delaria, there were quite a few little quotes or bullet points from her presentation that we all agreed that it was important for us to focus on as we work towards our own education and the education of the members of the community as far as what is this whole political movement, this political arena about, and what is our place in that arena. And she shared with us some statistics. She said we need to be at the table when policies are being made. And quoting the number of public officials in the United States, there are approximately 500,000 elected public officials. We're talking about the municipal, the city, the county, the state, the national level. With only, and actually less than 500, we're talking about out of 500,000, less than 500 identify as Muslims. And so that's 0.001%. When we know the demographics in terms of the population of Muslims in this country is far above what we're talking about, 0.001%. So we have to, number one, work towards preparing ourselves to taking on leadership responsibility locally, on the state level, on the federal level, and also preparing the next generation of our leaders. And while we're doing that, public officials, they have to know and understand Muslims. There's so much craziness that's going on. You look at it, what's going on right now in the Senate. The senators who are coming against, there is a brother, Adil Abdullah Manji, who is a judge. And they're balking on who's being confirmed at the federal judgeship level because of pro bono work that he did. Pro bono is the free work that attorneys perform for indigent people, people who can't afford to get legal representation. And generally state bars encourage or some even, you know, mandate X amount of hours that attorneys should do over a period of time. And so he did do some pro bono work, you know, in the criminal area. And so now they're trying to brand him as somebody who is soft on crime or against the police, you know, which is absolutely ridiculous. And so, but it just reflects on public officials who don't know or understand Muslims, who don't know or accept the fact that there are Muslims who are in this country whose foreparents were probably here before their foreparents were here. There was a program that I was listening to. I think I can't remember the name of it. I think it was on MSNBC. It was either on MSNBC or a program I was looking at on YouTube. And it was a woman from, I think she was from Indiana. I could hardly understand her. She was Ukrainian, and she was speaking on behalf of the spending bill for Ukraine. She was advocating for that. She was an elected official. She's a member of Congress, an elected official. She's there advocating on behalf of her issues. No one is criticizing her. You know, the other representatives are not criticizing her. It's obvious she just got here a little while ago. Yet and still, they will show and have more respect and more regard. And I'm not saying that she should be disrespected, but they will have more regard for and consider her more of a citizen than a Muslim whose family may have been here over 100 years, over 200 years. So it's very important that public officials know and they understand Muslims. We're not, it's just like they try to put all African-American Dalalian folks in one little box. We're not a monolithic community. We have different interests based on socioeconomic, you know, cultural norms. So they, the elected officials at the city, the municipal level, the district level, they have to get to know and understand Muslims where we are. And we have taken the responsibility of making laws for us and by us. The only way we do that is having elected officials in these various positions. And we can work in coalition. Governor Fleming is very good with working with many different coalitions, and we need to expand that mindset. Again, going back to the thinking, Imam Muhammad encouraged us to work with right-minded people and people who share our interests. And this is the basis of forming coalition. So I wanted to share that statistic that the sister, Dr. Saeed, shared with us. many, many months ago on our program. And thank you for bringing up. I did read about that gentleman in Oklahoma and his background. It seems like many Republicans, they don't have any shame in hiding their background, but they always okay, I'm going to stop. This is Ramadan. Anyhow, many of them point the finger at other people of different ethnic backgrounds to disqualify them based on where they claim that these other folks have come from. But anyway, I'm tired. You can see searching for that night of power is is catching up with me. But anyhow.
Yeah, I think you have Brother Fleming with his hand up. I think that's him.
You think
right?
That's Brother Fleming? Okay. All right. 9600.
Sure.
You want to let him in?
Yeah. Yeah, let's see if that's him.
All right.
He's calling from a different. He over here ghost calling from a different number, but.
He is ghost calling. I mean, he got so many different numbers, so many different titles. I just.
Can't
okay.
Keep up with
that.
Well, listen, I'm calling from my line phone today. Well, thank you, my salam, Ramadan Mubarak. Just listening and learning from my two sisters here. But I want to emphasize just a couple of things because I know the hour is moving forward. You know, I would encourage everyone listening, every soul that's listened before, go to your local board of elections and pull down the facts of who voted in the last two elections. They give you the breakdown. The percentage of voters is dismal. Let me say that again. The percentage of voters is dismal. Now, I'm going to try to be limited because I know I have only 30 seconds. But by the grace of Allah, I've been working this vineyard since Jimmy Carter. I've been what they call a commission person who went out into the community to knock on doors, get people registered to vote, and try to get them transportation to the polls. I mean, for years now, okay? So it's not a new thing. But in all of that effort, and we participated in Souls to the Poll for decades now, with all of that effort, we are still not coming to the polls. Now, in this last primary election, we had some county seats that were won by people who had already resigned from running again. Let me say that again. We had a county commissioner who had publicly resigned. He said his age, he's 84, 85. He decided he was not going to run again. Yet he got the third highest number of votes, even though he was no longer a candidate, because of the sheer lack of participation in the electoral process. And we had some people who were running for local city functions, like a city council person they called here, it varies from state to state, who won an election with 102 votes. Now, just let this sink in for a minute.
Wait a minute. A total of 102 votes?
A total of 102 votes.
In a city.
Now, you only have 8 wards in the city of Winston-Salem, right? So each city, the ward has about, it'll vary, you might have out of 250,000 people in the whole city. They try to divide it up evenly, okay? So one area of the city of Winston-Salem now won a position and replaced an incumbent who'd been there for a long time with 102 votes. I'm just demonstrating how lackadaisical, not just our people, when I say our, I mean collectively African Americans, Muslims included, were not coming out to the polls. Now, that has to really, really be examined very critically. I was on a panel discussion the day after the primaries with two other people trying to analyze what in the world happened. What's happening to our energy to want to participate in the electoral process? And I work with a group called the Ministers Alliance in Winston-Salem and vicinity, and all the ministers on board making their vans available to bring people to the polls, et cetera, and they can persuade the congregations to come out during the primary to participate on any large, significant scale. So there's an issue. I think it goes back, as you said earlier, Sister Amatullah, what Imam Muhammad said about our mindset. We have to have a mindset that says this country belongs to us. first and foremost. And we have to take responsibility for making a difference in the direction of this country. As long as you sit on the sideline and just critiquing and not participating, you get exactly what you get. You've got to be engaged. You've got to be informed. And you've got to participate, brothers and sisters. Now, I do have some critical news I want to share, and then I'm going to go to some good news. Critical news from one state, the state of Tennessee. Some of you may have heard that Tennessee State, the whole Board of Trustees was replaced by the General Assembly in the state of Tennessee.
Oh,
the whole Board of Trustees. Now, let that sink in. That's an HBCU. That's just the tip of the iceberg of what they're trying to do in some of these General Assemblies to our historically black universities and schools. We're concerned in North Carolina because we have the largest number of HBCUs in the country. We have about 14.
Yeah.
They've been around since, you know, the Civil War. Right after the Civil War, they started building these universities with very little means other than just a vision and the, you know, the commitment to make these things happen. So that happened in Tennessee. There was a very critical piece that came up that said our corporate civil rights organizations were not responding like they should have to address that issue, specifically the NAACP, Urban League. I won't go down the whole list. But they're not giving that kind of vigor to challenge what happened in Tennessee. Now, believe me, if it happens like that in Tennessee, it's just a matter of time before it's also addressed in other states. So we got to be informed. We got to stay active. We got to participate. The thing that I'm concerned, elevated by my spirit, I was so glad, some of you I'm sure aware of this, when they finally cut the ribbon on the Clara Senior Citizen Complex in Washington, D.C., fantastic facility for our senior citizens and others who want to live there, a magnificent structure. It took them quite a bit of cooperation, of course, with Coalition Building to make that happen, and now they're building a $5 million addition to the Masjid there. And they're allowing their Masjid services to be held in a Christian church until the facility is completed for the Muslim community. Why am I saying that? We have to have relationships with other groups. We have to have strong interfaith relationships, working relationships. So if something like that happens in your small community, you have another option to have your services to be continued. It's very important, brothers and sisters, going forward. And if we have the universal perspective of life and this religion, a balanced one, not an extreme one, we can make those things happen. But I just applaud the community in Washington, D.C. for the efforts in making that happen. Inshallah, I've been in D.C. a couple of times for this month for some various conferences, and I told the brothers I'd come by and just applaud them and thank them for being vigorous, because it took some dedication to bring that about and a lot of cooperation. So, again, the nation's mosque in Washington, D.C., cut the ribbon on the Clara, of course named after Sister Clara Muhammad, the wife of Warishuddin Muhammad's, the wife of the Honorary Elijah Muhammad, and, of course, the mother of Imam Warishuddin Muhammad. May Allah always bless him for his sacrifice among us and to the world at large. And then I got to make one little note, and I'll take only 30 seconds. Keep me on check now. We have an insane lady. We have an insane lady who just defeated our state superintendent to run in the general election to become the superintendent for all the schools across the state of North Carolina. Now, I think I sent a copy of some of her comments to both of you. How insane this lady is. She replaced an incumbent superintendent of the public schools in the state. This lady was advocating committing treason and beheading President Obama. She went on a whole list of things she was advocating. And she was also in Washington, D.C., if that insanity, when they tried the insurrection. And she actually won in North Carolina to compete again, of course, in November. Thank God, alhamdulillah, she's running against a brother whose name is Mo Green, who used to be superintendent of Greensboro Kiffler County Schools, and he's done a lot of things in the community-related education, got a lot of push behind him. In fact, he's coming to town this Wednesday. And a lot of people are supporting him across the state. But just to give you an idea how some of these people thinking, and they're getting some of these very critical positions, and if we don't stay active, stay involved, vote. Don't give me no excuses. Vote and participate and get others to go with you to the polls. It's very critical, brothers and sisters. And, you know, I can go beyond 30 seconds, but I'm going to pause right there and just say alhamdulillah, and let's move on with this fantastic program we got scheduled for today. Thank you for my 30 seconds.
I wanted to ask two questions on the issues that you brought up, Brother Fleming. on the Tennessee State, you know, there are a few states that have been negligent in funding the HBCUs based on the money that has come in. So they've gotten the money and they pocketed it or kept it to the side or rather than to pass the money on to the HBCU. Is that an issue there for Tennessee State, do you know? That's one question.
That is the issue. That's the issue.
They had a balance that was due to be paid to that HBCU. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, it's underfunded.
Well, let's go ahead, Sister Cheryl.
Yeah, it was underfunded. They gave them money, but they underfunded them, and they gave them infrastructure money that was underfunded. So while they did give them money, they underfunded them compared to what they gave.
They didn't give them the proper allotment.
They didn't give them
allotment.
Right. And but I will tell you, and Brother Fleming, you can please contribute to what I'm going to say. It wasn't just that they replaced the board. They replaced the board with this is Ramadan, so let me be diligent with my words. They replaced them with pale members.
Yes.
Of the board. They replaced them with an entire board of pale members. So that is what, and people who were not understanding of the historical black nature of the university, that is what the rub was. It's not just that they replaced the board, because sometimes you got to replace the board, and people understand that. But who they replaced them with became the issue. Now, that said, this may be an opportunity, and I know people might not like this, this may be an opportunity to show that it's not people on the board, it's the fact that it's underfunded. So let's see if all of a sudden funding shows up. Now that we got some other people in there, let's see if funding shows up, or let's see if the critical issues still continue with this lack of funding. And the same people who are doing the mismanagement of the funding are the same critical issues continue regardless of who's in those seats, because it is a fundamental issue of there's not enough funding, because their argument was that we gave you this funding and you gave it away as scholarships to students. So this is what the complaint was, Sister Amatola. Is that we gave you funding and you keep giving the money to the students and putting money in the infrastructure. Well, what do you want us to do? You said it was infrastructure money. But the same issues are happening with other students like University of Tennessee, and they're not getting as much scrutiny as, you know, UT isn't getting the same scrutiny, and they have the same type of financial line items as TSU. You follow?
Yes.
Knoxville,
this,
is that the same issue?
This practice is a practice that many of the state legislatures in the, I'll call them, deep south areas have been using for years as far as not funding the full allotment to the HBCUs. The concerns that I have, I did see, or I read actually, the statement. There was a student who was a member of the board. He had a really good statement that he made when he was appealing for them not to replace the board. What I want to know, do you have any information, Brother Fleming, on how active were TSU alumni in this whole process?
I don't have an article in front of me, but I can give you some information I know about another institution where the same question was raised. And I'm pretty sure it's the common storyline across the border there. Let me give you a specific. In North Carolina, a lot of the HBCUs merged with the university system because of lack of support when it came to buildings on campus, et cetera. So now you might have the largest HBCU that we have in North Carolina, Santee State University, but it's a part of the University of North Carolina system. Winston-Salem State University, an HBCU, is now part of the University of North Carolina system. You can go down the line. Elizabeth State University is now part of the University of North Carolina system. Now, that system governs all the colleges that are publicly identified in the state of North Carolina. You have a few exceptions that are still private schools, like Johnson C. Smith in Charlotte. It's a private entity. Barbara Scotia, private entity, et cetera. But the majority of them had become a part of the system to survive long term because the alumni was not supporting them, nor was the state allocating to them sufficient funds to maintain sustainable infrastructures. And that's a historical problem. One of the strongest advocates for that is Congressman Dr. Alma Adams. Since she arrived in Congress, she's been pushing for more funding for historically black universities and colleges from day one. And she's gotten some support across the aisle and pushing that envelope. But it has been a historical issue. And I've been very critical of, you know, the alma mater that my wife retired from, Winston-Salem State University. They had a chance to acquire a stadium not far from the campus. They've been playing football over there for years. But you also have at that stadium a racing track. And the racing track community in this city is like a religion. You know, because you're, again, it's a southern thing, right? And so they protested when the idea came up that Winston-Salem State University could own that stadium if they just contributed a dollar and accept responsibility for maintaining it. Now, that was the crux. Did they have the resources to maintain that stadium? The bottom line, no, they did not. And so that stadium they used for all the programs is still, unfortunately, owned by the city of Winston-Salem, even though it's right in the backyard of Winston-Salem State University. And my critique, and I was on the campus many times on this opportunity, I said, why can't we raise $1 million from the alumni to let the people know that indeed we're committed to preserving this as a part of WSSU? We went to the National Alumni of WSSU, asked for $1 million. I think maybe $125,000 came in. Now, there are a lot of reasons we could say we got such what I consider an embarrassing amount back, because that school has been around. It's the first school to give African Americans in North Carolina teaching certification. It used to be called Teachers College for years. So I'm talking about going back to 1905. And so you have to wonder, what is in our thinking that make us think that we're not to give back once we receive? It's a terrible mindset. We have to give back. Mm. We have to give back. We have to be charitable. And, you know, my mother-in-law graduated from that school back in the 40s, and she was Miss Alumni. That population that came in the 40s gave the greatest amount of money to that school even to this day. They give because they saw the life difference in that they experienced once they graduated versus working on farms or being one step beyond a sharecropper, et cetera. They saw her at that school change her license and change her projection. So those who graduated in the 40s, they get big bucks. You come up to the 80s, even though these kids have more opportunities, more, quote, professional experiences, it's minimum compared to what those people who graduated in the 40s, because it was a part of the heart, part of the culture. So it's an issue we got to deal with. What makes us think that we're not to give back? And that's a psychological thing, too. So I do put the blame sometime on the alumni. I look at, we have other schools in the city. Wake Forest University is right in my backyard almost. You have School of the Arts, part of the UNC system. Wake Forest University has an alumni that gives $20 million as a sole person, not to mention the kind of funds they get in from the alumni across the board. In a particular campus. Mm-hmm. I mean, they support their school 100%. At least the funding looks like 100%, but the dollar amount is phenomenal compared to what's them to the university right across town, you know. So it's an issue as a people we got to really look at. And I think we got a good start with the concept behind the Nation of Islam to do something for ourselves, to be commissioned to do something for yourself, to think for yourself, and to love yourself enough to put your money where your mouth is to support each other going forward with examples. That's why I applaud the people, again, in Washington, D.C., who sort of set an example of what can be done if we work together with actual facilities that will last, inshallah, eons going forward, because they included also a museum piece in that facility and a lot of other, you know, components. One day, inshallah, we'll have Imam Talib to come on and talk in more detail about how they've been able to make that happen, inshallah. But yes, alumni,
well,
step up to the plate and do more.
Yeah. On the Clara, I agree with you. They really, the Muslim community there should really be applauded because that physical, tangible asset to me, in the way I look at it, is what we're encouraging people to do, and that is to put faith into action. And for them to be able to have that facility there, it takes a tremendous amount of patience, consensus building. You know, a lot of times we may get in a group, and if there are different opinions, the group falls to pieces because people don't take the time to try to build consensus. You know, sometimes people will try and bully their way through to get their opinion or their way of doing something rather than to take the time to try to build consensus. Consensus building is very difficult to do, but it's necessary to get the type of support to be able to reach the goal that you're going after. And I think that the fiasco that we see happening in Washington, D.C. now, in particularly the House, but, you know, it's true in the Senate, too, with some legislation. If you're not willing to, they use the terminology, work across the aisle, okay? If you're not willing to do that, to work with people who may have fundamental policy differences, then you have a different perspective. If you don't try to work towards a common ground, then you're not going to get anything done. So that's why we see the gridlock. That's one of the reasons. We see the gridlock that we see in the House of Representatives right now because, you know, just to put it frankly, the Republicans, they have taking the position that they're not going to get the help of the Democrats, especially when it comes to the budget and spending. You know, they are not going to, I mean, they've made public statements, and people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, she is calling to vacate the chair to try and get rid of Mike Johnson. She just hasn't put a date on it, but it's like, how you take a hatchet and you hold it over somebody's head, and if they make one wrong move, you know, the hatchet is going to come down. But that's that narrow mind of not building consensus, not working together to try and come to a common ground and have something that's going to benefit everyone. So I applaud the believers there in D.C. because internally, they had to hold together, and then they had to work with government officials to pull the project together. You know, so it is a bright shining star of what we can do when we put our faith into action. And I share your happiness with that, Brother Fleming. I was very, I did see the ceremony they had, it was on YouTube, and it was very, very inspiring. if Washington, D.C. wasn't so cold, I might even think about trying to get in a get an apartment back there, but that can't give up this California sunshine.
I hear you, sis.
We just have to build a Clara Park too out here on the West Coast.
California Clara.
California Clara, yes, definitely.
Yes,
but
you know, you reminded me of something. I happen to know the local Forsyth County Republican chair because we both served on the Board of Elections for a couple of terms, in fact, before I became a county commissioner. And I would kid with him sometimes because I know he graduated from Salem State University. He was a football player, but he couldn't make first string because he just wasn't physically fit. And I would say, I won't call his name, but I'll just tell you what I would ask him. I said, have you ever read the book Common Sense? He said, Common Sense about what, Alamein? I said, I would suggest you go back and Google Common Sense. The book itself, now, not the expression, the book itself that was used to convince these early people in this country to adopt this new way of government. It would do you a lot of good to just go back and read the book Common Sense. But a lot of them, they don't have any kind of foundational knowledge. You know, it's hard to argue with someone if they don't have foundational knowledge about issues. And you have to just take the time to educate them sometimes, or at least challenge your thinking to the degree that, you know, you make them want to go back and do for more research instead of just talking out of the side of their mouths about issues. And I used to debate a guy on the radio every morning at 7 o'clock. He used to fundraiser for the Republican Party. African-American brother named, I'll say his name, Algernon Cash, because we're pretty good associates. And he always has this very conservative perspective about everything. And I said, Algernon, I know where you grew up, man. I know your grandmother. I know the community you grew up in, behind the Zesto. How do you come out of a shotgun house that you can look straight through and think that your philosophy is supposed to be that conservative, so there's nothing the government can do for you ever? You can do it all by yourself. I said, that's the biggest lie. Somebody caught you at birth and cut that umbilical cord. You're not coming to this world by yourself, so forget about that nonsense, man. And we go back and forth about issues. You know, he said, Brother Fleming, I always learn something from you, because I'd always give him a book to read. I said, look, man, read this, please, before we debate again, so we can have a foundation to work from. And don't just give me an opinion. I want some facts and some references. I didn't mean to cut you off, so it just came to mind when you were talking about that situation.
No. That's good points. I think, though, that we should probably break for a PSA because we've gone quite a little bit. And then when we come back, I want to talk about we're going to talk about money and politics and money.
Yes, ma'am.
Looking at the couple of points I wanted to bring out about the budget that was passed by the Congress that got Mike Johnson into trouble, but I'm going to connect some of that with some of the international issues, but also tie it in with your last point as far as, are we really educating people ourselves first, each individual, educating yourself, and educating the general community, general population on the issues, and for people to be able to see if not the whole picture, at least more of the picture, so that we just don't rely on what a newspaper headline says or what a TV or radio commentator or podcast commentator says, but are people really taking the time to find out what is behind the issues? So, Sister Cheryl.
Let me correct myself, too. I said 102 votes in that ward. It was 1,002 votes. I apologize. He won by 1,002 votes, not 102 votes.
Okay.
I just got a little reminder on the screen.
Yeah, but that, I mean, you know, even that is a pitiful showing. But, okay,
yes,
it's not as bad as 102.
Yes.
I had to ask you 102.
Yes.
You can throw a party or a barbecue and get more than that.
Well, we had a guy win with 10 votes. We had a guy win with 10 votes. He got upset with 10 votes for a special district out here. And it was funny because he was the incumbent, and his friend is his so-called friend was the one who beat him. You can get 10 votes at a happy hour.
you know.
Wait a minute, Sister Cheryl. Cheryl, wait. You got to stop. He was the incumbent. And are you saying that only 10 people voted for him? For his victory margin?
He lost by 10 votes. It was a cop because he is who beat him by 10 votes. It was only 136 people who voted. It's right here in Crockett, Martinez area.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a special district. And it was in the last election cycle, not this past one, but the 2020, the midterms. And what was interesting was that happens all the time in that area where you only need a few hundred votes. Only a few hundred people turn out to vote. And this was it's very upsetting to some of us who have to have, like in my district, I got to have as many votes as, you know, a mayor. So we got to have, you know, tens of thousands of votes in our special district. And in some areas, you only need 500 votes. And and it's a water district. So we laugh, but, you know, water is gold in California. So when we're at our meetings, we're like, when we go to our special district meetings, or where we're like, we'll be in D.C. next week, and we're laughing about this because we're like, some people spend, like down in Silicon Valley, you spend as much as the congressional rate to get on a special district board or a water board, because it's big, it's a big deal, and you spend more than a city council or some, like I said, almost as much as congressional district. It might cost you, you know, $350,000, almost $500,000 to run a competitive water district race in parts of the Bay. And then you have some people who in a race and it's 100 votes. I'm like, where they live? Where they live? And this one lady told me in Southern California, she rode around on her bike and handed out flyers. She made it to the coffee shop. And I was like, are you
kidding
me?
That's what I was going to say. I could go to Coffee Central and get my campaign flyers going. Okay.
Yay.
Well, let's go on to that PSA.
It depends where you are. But sewer district and water district is really, really big deal out here. And in some parts of the South and, you know, I would say that entire what we call the Bible Belt and the Rust Belt in the East Coast and the entire coast of the country, it's a huge deal. And down the middle of the country, it's a huge deal. So it depends on what position you are looking for. I tell people that when we're doing trainings for candidates and for consultants. Know the position, know what you're looking for, so you know what you're getting into. But yeah, it could be 10 votes or it could be 10,000 votes. But what are you getting yourself into?
Right. Okay.
But the money, big deal. So let's go to a PSA, and then we're going to come back and talk about the money. I wanted to give us a good segue into this. But that money trail.
Sounds good. That money trail is a big trail. That's it.
And you better get some good hiking boots on. Get your hiking boots on, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
Assalamu alaikum, and thank you for supporting the CWSC AM360 annual Ramadan Telethon, which helps us financially secure our intelligentsia operations. And some of those operations are as follows. The American Muslim 360 Broadcasting Network, Speakers Bureau, Online National Resource Directory, Volunteer Human Resource Network, The Think Tank, College Scholarship Program, Teams, working together, such as with the Learning Lab, Intrafaith and Interfaith Collaborative, Internship and Leadership Development Programs, Ambassador Programs, and International Collaborative. Please visit us online to see more of the intelligentsia and the annual report. For your mailing in your donation, you can send it to CWSC Inc., Marina Village, 4905 34th Street South, number 185, St. Petersburg, Florida, 33711-4511. Make your check or money order payable to CWSC, Inc. Thank you, and stay tuned for more information on the Ramadan Telethon.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Dabrita Hadi, Director of the MCNRD Model Community National Resource Directory, reminding volunteers of our upcoming MCNRD Social Connect Conference every last Sunday of the month, 1 o'clock p.m. to 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We look forward to your participation, so please check your email for conference call information. Thank you so kindly. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to AM 360. Join your host, Manira Habil, every Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as we explore relationship topics addressing what we didn't know, what we've learned, and what we need to know and why. Because on this show, it's all about courtship and marriage.
Peace be on you.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Edward Willis, advisor at Graceline Community, asking you to join me in supporting community-wide Shura Conference at American Muslim 360. Make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or phone in your pledge to 910-317-0297. Again, make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or by phone at 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake the world. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Nirmat Shaheed, restorative justice practitioner for the Oakland Unified School District and host on AM 360's The Pearls of Women Quranic Mondays. We're asking you to help us make a difference in the life of a student. We need you to spread the word that CWSC is offering 5 college scholarships in the form of direct financial aid to students who qualify and are graduating from high school this year or current college students. Learn more and apply online today at cwsc.us. But hurry, the deadline for applications is June the 20th. Thank you for helping secure our next generation's intelligentsia. Assalamu alaikum.
Join us for Muslim American Power 5 on Mondays, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Muslim American Power 5, referred to as MAP 5, featuring Sister Amatullah Sabri, Sister Cheryl Sadu, and Brother Fleming Alamein. That's Monday, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time for MAP, Muslim American Power 5.
Okay. All right. before we look at the money trail, you know, there was this program, I haven't looked at TV like that in years, but I think it was called 24 or something, where this cabinet member, there was some kind of cataclysmic event. He was maybe the Secretary of the Interior or something. All of a sudden now he's in charge. Kiefer Sutherland used to play in it. Something happened. Oh, I know what. You know, there's a lot of, I won't say there's a lot. There is some talk among conservative circles about whether or not Joe Biden is going to be the candidate, you know, when we come to November. That's a whole nother conversation. Anyway, someone was saying, well, Kamala would definitely not be, Kamala Harris, vice president, would definitely not be the president. Well, who would be? So it made me think about succession, and I think it's important for people to realize this because we never know what will happen. The line of succession after the president is the vice president. The third person in place is the Speaker of the House. It's Mike Johnson, okay, who most Americans did not, myself included, did not know a lot about until Kevin McCarthy was kicked out. And then after that is the president pro tempore of the Senate. And that current person is Patty Murray. And after Patty Murray is the Secretary of State, that's Antony Blinken. Then the Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen. Then the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. Then the Attorney General, Merrick Garland. So I think those first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we may know, we may have heard their names more frequently than the rest of the cabinet members. But that's a little side factoid that I thought I would throw in there before we look at the money, because it's very important when an administration comes in to see what does their cabinet look like in the event that something comes up. So I just wanted to throw that in as a side, a little side note. Now, we know that in the House, for example, the House members particularly scream about the spending, GOP spending. Not to mention that the spending mushroom when number 45 got in there and initiated this tremendous tax savings for the wealthy. And how does that come into play? The debt is based on, just like with us, If I make $4,000 a month and my expenses, that's what I have coming in, $4,000, and my expenses are $5,500 a month, every month I'm in what they call the red. I'm in debt because I don't have enough coming in to take care of what's going out. And that's the same principle with the government, expenses. So right now, the national debt of the United States is $34 trillion as of January 4th. And CNBC reported that the national debt is rising by $1 trillion about every 100 days. So before the year is over, we're going to have another $2 to $3 trillion in debt. And so many fiscally conservative folks, they cry benefits. We can't give more Head Start. We can't give more whatever that is what they categorize or put into the social network category. But the thing that they don't want to do is to tax the extremely wealthy. I don't know if either one of you saw the headline where I think it was they said billionaires rush back to support number 45. And reading the article and the reporters, the reports that they have given says that the reason why this billionaire class, and they named some of them, some people, the average Joe would not even know. If we're not talking about like the Jeff Bezos from Amazon or the Bill Gates. We're talking about those incognito to the general public billionaires. The guy that was the richest. Now, this is a title to have, right? He's the richest man in Pennsylvania. The whole state of Pennsylvania has pledged to give $20 million to the Trump campaign. And this is after when January 6th occurred. He was one of the ones that spoke out. He was just so disgusted by what Trump did. They blamed Trump. But now, 3 years later, his little pocket change of $20 million, he is willing to donate to this man's campaign. So, Cheryl, you were mentioning as far as the disparity between running a campaign in, let's say, Crockett, California, versus running a campaign in Palo Alto, the difference between maybe a couple of $100 to a couple of $100,000. So that puts a tremendous pressure on people who want to run or who would be qualified to run some for public office, whether or not they put themselves under that strain to get out there and get the financial support that is required to run a political campaign. And this is why we have some of the least, let's say the least qualified people who are holding positions because they bend to the will of the folks that control the money. And I know that, Cheryl, a couple of times you have mentioned on this program about the need for us when we identify candidates who represent our interests, then we have to be willing to support the candidate, not just with the vote, but with the financial resources to be able to run a campaign, to be able to get people to vote for them. $26 million in one night, they claimed that Biden was able to raised the other night with the Obama-Clinton Biden trio that was doing their high-kicking up on the stage at Radio City Music Hall. We used to go there and see the dancers who were, I forget what the name of.
The Rockettes.
The Rockettes, exactly, the Rockettes. So the three of them did their little Rockette routine the other night, $26 million. Now, Trump, he's going to have his Mar-a-Lago dinner, and he's boasting. You never can tell, you know, how he inflates everything, that they're going to get $33 million. And they're going to be up there in the millions because he's really significantly behind in his campaign as far as Biden so far has outpaced him, as well as so much money from what he gets from his grifting routine goes first to his paying his legal expenses. And then once the legal expenses are taken care of, the campaign expenses, and then once the campaign expenses are taken care of, then the other candidates. That might give an opening for better candidates to be able to prevail on the Democratic side. I don't know. We're not Republicans. We're not Democrats. We got to look for the people that best serve our interests. But the point that I'm raising is that there is so much money in the politics from day one, from a person declaring their candidacy to when they, if they win, when they have to, and from what they say is almost immediately, they have to start fundraising and getting money right away as soon as they're in office to be able to be reelected in the congressional side every 2 years or in the Senate side every 6 years. So it's really an elitist game. That's the point that I'm making, that the money in the politics is really affecting the politics and affecting the quality of the candidates that we get. And I think for most of us, that's above our head. We don't see that. Because we haven't been educated or trained to see it or to really appreciate how much the little guy is squeezed from both ends and then can't sometimes get the quality representation because, again, the money is a barrier. Any comments from the two of you? I know I've covered a lot of different ways from the budget deficit to the price of, you know, being in a campaign. But that, to me, there is a connection there because what is happening is the wealthy class is able to control the legislative class so that the common person is really the one who's footing the bill and who's under the pressure. Because the ones that have more money, they don't want to pay. They don't want to pay their fair share in taxes. They don't want to increase the expenditure that comes into the government to be able to pay down that debt. What say you, Brother Fleming? Do I have it right or do I have it wrong?
You have it 1,000% right. And I give you a couple of examples. I'll try to only take 35 seconds because I know Sister Cheryl has been on the watch. But if you look at NACO, NACO stands for the National Association of County Officials, and there are about 4,600 county commissioners across the state. And we meet once a year, you know, in various parts of the country, sometimes even as far away as Hawaii, depends on what the delegation vote for the previous convention to be held at. But when you go to an event like that, you see the huge disparity. You have some counties that may have three commissioners, very poor counties. Let's say in parts of Mississippi, I know some specifically in that area, and they can't afford to even send their commissioners to the convention. So the commissioner has to go in his own pocket just to get to the convention. That's one example, okay? Then you have a state like New York, tons of money, you know. I won't even identify how many commissioners you have in the state of New York, but it's the wealthiest state. So they subsidize their commissioners to come to conventions like that. Even North Carolina, with 100 counties, there's a big variance between what you would consider agrarian counties that rely heavily on agriculture versus your five major cities that are pretty much urban areas. They would have, on the average, maybe seven commissioners, except for Charlotte. Charlotte has about 25 commissioners. It's a very huge city. But they underwrite the expense of their commissioners going to these conventions. And why am I saying that? Just to reinforce the idea that money in politics has the biggest voice. Now, Should it be that way? You know, that's for us to decide as citizens. But if you look at any serious article on Congress, for example, many of them critique Congress as a millionaire's club, because you've got to have money to just compete to go to Congress, and you have the interests of millionaires being surfaced at the front of a lot of those agendas. Now, some of your state assemblies are a little different. North Carolina has a part-time lawmaking body in the General Assembly. However, how many everyday people can afford to go down to Raleigh, get a space accommodation in terms of an apartment or house, and come back to your district on a day-to-day basis to a regular job? It doesn't happen that way. You have people who have wealth to go down there because they can afford to go down there and get a part-time salary and maintain a position as a state senator or a state representative. If you don't have that kind of resources, you cannot successfully go down there. And I know some tragic cases of people who were school teachers who had no idea because they didn't do their homework, as Officer Cheryl said, about what's required of the job. Didn't realize they would lose their position as a teacher and was relying on their little part-time money to sustain themselves, and they had to come out because they did not do the homework properly on the front end. So by design, you have to have resources to run a campaign. Now, here's the exception. We have a young man in Forsyth County. He's been a county commissioner for 44 years. He's a farmer by profession. He puts up 3-yard signs when he runs the campaign. And the area of Forsyth County he lives in, they admire this man so much because he's ultra-conservative. He's a non-pretentious guy. He wears suspenders sometimes on his coat. He doesn't try to impress you with a conversation. He speaks what I call in 1 to 2 sentences, but he's very honest. He will tell you exactly how he feels about an issue. So you know what he's thinking. He does not try to deceive you with a lot of words. He just tells you, well, I think we should do this, and this is why I think it. You can agree with me or disagree, but this is my position on it. And that's the way he talks. But people in that area that he lives in, they respect him because of that. Now, he told me, he said, Fleming, I spent $100 on my campaign. He got 15,700 votes. He's been in that position for a long time, so he's earned the respect of that community, okay? Then you have other areas where people have to spend $30,000 just to get their name recognition out there to be a county commissioner. So, and a lot of that, unfortunately, is where we have some of the largest population centers. And even then, we may get 14,000 people out in a commission region, maybe 12,000 people out. I think the first time I ran, I got about 15,000 votes. Anyway, but the variance again is money makes a difference in political arenas. You have the greatest access to your local positions, whether it's a city council person, because you have a small population, but you've got to have resources. And, of course, you're dealing with a less cost-prohibitive situation when you're dealing with a smaller region like that. But you've got to have money. Science costs money. Literature costs money. Telephone, things that you have to call people on costs money. You've got to get your picture out there and your voice out there. Especially if you don't have a record of community service. And that, I'll say, is really the big difference. Some people, because they work in the community all their lives or a big part of their lives, they have a known reputation. Those people can just put a sign in their car and ride through the city. People say, oh, so-and-so is winning. Okay, I'm going to vote for this person because I know this person. I know that person. I know their history of work. But the average person, if you don't have the community record, community service record, it's cost prohibitive. So, again, the Millionaire's Club in Congress or the part-time situation in the state of North Carolina, but you got to have money to be able to go down there to afford to be a part-time legislator. Or on the local level, city council, you got to have money. Some people put a lot of money into billboards and that kind of thing. But I was advised a long time ago, don't invest money in things that don't really impact your target market a whole lot. And the biggest target market you can make is your work in the community. You got to put your name out there, but do the work, and the work will produce results for you. But money is a prohibitive factor, and you got to give, brothers and sisters. Don't just vote. Give. Share your resources. Call somebody up and say, listen, I know this person, contribute $5 to, you know, campaign or whatever you can afford to give them, because they need resources to run an effective campaign. And on the congressional side, those guys are going for 2 years, those congressmen, it takes them about a year just to get to know where the bathrooms are in those buildings. And then you got to take mm-hmm. 6 months just to get your network together to raise money. So you may be effective for maybe out of those 2 years, 2 or 3 months trying to push forward some kind of bill, then the cycle starts all over again. So you have the tragedy of somebody like a Strom Thurmond who stayed till he was 102 years old. Can you imagine? And the last part of his life, he was his secretary, his administrative assistant was running the office, but he was just hooked into that power thing. And some people just do that. And the guy from West Virginia was just a little bit better than that. You know, you're 90-something years of age, and you're still trying to make decisions on the spot like that. It just don't happen that way. So that's enough on that. We can talk about budget process if you want to next. And remind me to talk about what we call PAYGO funds when it comes to county government. When we come back around to my opportunity to spend 30 seconds again. Thank you very much.
Okay. Cheryl, did you have a quick comment?
Yes. The tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So the tragedy of American politics is that it costs money. The triumph of American politics is that it costs money. For most black and brown people, that part is what is a barrier participating in politics. It's not just that you have to ask people for money, but you got to come in it with money. The part that always astounds me is that we always think that the money is going to come from somewhere else. No, money's going to come from you. Nope, money going to come from you. It's always funny when people think that somebody else is going to give you the money. No, the money comes from you. If you don't have the money to run, don't run. When somebody else gives you the money, there's a bonus. There's a bonus. If you can do some fundraising and you can raise some money to help offset the cost of running, great. But you have to go in this knowing that I'm going to have to pay that money. So when you do your research, you know, I am the chair of our county training committee, our county party training committee. And right now I'm getting ready to I'm getting the paperwork ready to train the new crop of people who have aspirations to run for office. And one of the trainings I'm getting ready to do is just this, what we're talking about right now. And the first part of it is the first two sessions. I'm not even talking about running for office. The first two sessions is an assessment, personal assessment. And so I want this audience to know right now what I'm going to be telling them. And the first assessment is, so you think you want to run for office, huh? Is this for you? Is this for you? Who told you? Are you ready to run for office? Who told you that this is for you? Your mama and your sister, they don't count. They don't count. Your best friend, they don't count. Because people will gas you up and tell you that this is what you should need to do. Oh, no, you're perfect for this. You've been doing so much in the community, like Brother Fleming just said. You need to run for this. But guess what? They're not the ones who are going to be up on the dice, listening to people call you a whole bunch of names that your mama and your grandmother did not give you. They're not the ones who are going to be sitting there, you know, when you're trying to just buy some onions and potatoes for dinner, make your famous, you know, or all the ingredients to make your grandmother's famous jambalaya recipe, and people stop you in the grocery store and will not let you go for that last vote you just took.
Yes.
On council, one of them praising you and one of them berating you. They are not going to be there when you got to be there past the 4 hours that your statute allows, and you got to keep. It's always one or two who just cannot stop with the soliloquy. They're not going to be there when you have to make decisions that are not popular but are right. They're not going to be there when you don't win. Because guess what? Just like winning is possible, losing is much more possible, much more possible. And that's really the more possible result than winning. And they're not going to be there after you didn't sink 100,000, tens of thousands, or whatever, of the money that you should be putting into, you know, something else for your household into these campaigns. So the same people who are gassing you up should be telling you the truth. You're not ready for these right now. You've got this huge thing at your job that you're trying to do. You've been waiting for this promotion for 2 years. Are you sure you're ready for this? You got a newborn baby that you need to be at home with. You got a teenage child who needs your attention because they're the vulnerable part of their life. You sure? You're newly married. You should be spending your time trying to make sure your marriage don't fall apart, or you've been having problems in your marriage for the last 4 years. You sure you want to give your attention to this when you should be trying to make sure that your marriage don't fall apart? That's the self-assessment that you need to be trying to have. Do you know how much time this is going to take? Whether it's election, appointed, a commissioner, volunteer, those are the kind of things we fool ourselves into believing that we can have it all or we can handle it all. I'm not saying this to discourage people. I'm saying this to make sure you have a clear understanding of what you're doing. That's why we don't see a lot of us in elected office, if truth be told. That's why you see a lot of pale people in these positions of power and influence, because they have the ability to have a me at home, Sister Matala, a you at home. Right? I don't have another me at home taking care of my family. So I had to be strategic. I had to negotiate with my children, negotiate with my husband. I had to make sure that I had the I's dotted and the T's crossed and everything lined up at home before I could step out into the community. And I had to make sure that everything was, you know, nothing was going to be neglected in my household, and make sure that, you know, nothing is going to be neglected in my professional life. Because if that falls apart, political life is not going to happen. But those are the conversations we need to have with ourselves. Too quickly we jump out and we announce we're running for something without making sure that everything else is lined up. The money comes in because it's too easy. Somebody comes in and they say, I'll give you this money to run. Don't worry about it. I know you got to work full time, but I'll take care of that. And that's when we get into trouble. But if you make sure that you work for, if you're going to run in 2028, which is what we should be looking and recruiting people for in our community, then we should not be talking about in 2024 supporting people for how do we get somebody to run right now in April, getting them to run for a school board in 2024. That should have been done already. That doesn't mean we can't. It just means it should have been done already, because right now they're behind the eight ball. But if we're going to be raising money, let's be raising money for 2026 and 2028 so that they start off right, so that they're training, so that we're sending them to school board meetings, we're sending them to town council meetings or city council meetings, so they can understand the dynamic of the demographic and the layout of the land and what's going on in the school meetings. And as people get to know them, as Brother Fleming said, and their name becomes synonymous with the core values of that town. And then when you ask them, Sister Amatala, will you donate $25 to my campaign? He's not only is it not a stranger, but he's not somebody who I don't know anything about, and I don't know that they won't vote and they won't carry out the mandate that we as a community of voters have determined what we need. So you start 4, 6, 8 years before you even contemplate running for office. I've been doing this work for 20 years before I decided to run for office, or before I was recruited, I should say, to run for office. And just because somebody tells you need to run, that's not always a good thing. Because I can tell you, the first time somebody asked me to run and I agreed, that was not a good decision. That was not. So we are tired. We should be we should be, and I'm going to say this from experience, we should be moving from just being seen and tokenized and having limited access to power and moving towards empowering ourselves, positions of power and influence and impacting ourselves to not only be a part of the political system, but actually running the show. I think that representation matters, but it should matter more than being tokenized, more than being seen in these positions. But it should be, our representation should be in a sense that we are changing the system in the way where it's needed most. That is where I see that we need to be nourishing our community in a way that we're planting seeds that is going to manifest our destiny for tomorrow. That's where I see us going in 2028, 2030, and beyond. That's it. That's all.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Good points, both of you, Brother Fleming and Sister Cheryl. Sister Cheryl, we have one person online, I believe, who has their hand up. I want to get them in. We got about 18 more minutes left on the broadcast, and I do have some more points I want to make. So, online, caller, question or comment? You got your hand up.
Malaykum
Asalaam.
Ramadan Mubarak. Amitallah, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My question has to do with positions that appear to be mostly full-time, but on paper they are part-time. These are elective positions as well as the compensation. So those persons obviously have to have other sources of income, employment, or some way to support themselves financially. So is it their private business, or do we have a responsibility, or do we have a right to know where the persons are actually being financed? Would that possibly affect their positions in these positions that have a lot of responsibility and even a lot of power, but not a lot of pay? For example, the here in Milwaukee, the county supervisors get very little pay, but those are very important positions just in terms of resources that they can supply to other people that are not a part of the government.
Well, I don't know about Wisconsin specifically, but in general, people who are elected into positions, they have public disclosure forms that they have to fill out every year where they have to list, you know, the investment income they get, employment income, business income. So I would imagine that there in Wisconsin that would be the norms, because you don't want any no public disclosure would definitely open the door for corruption. So there must be some kind of disclosure that's required. Brother Fleming or Sister Cheryl, do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I would hope that anyone run. Go ahead, Sister Cheryl. I'll follow you. Go ahead.
Just really quickly, it would only be if there is a conflict that one has to reveal, you know, their source of income, or if there is a conflict with their, I call it mortgage-paying job. Most of us don't have a problem revealing that, whether it's a consulting job or it's a full-time job. But usually, if it's a conflict, you have to reveal it. Sir?
Brother Fleming?
Yeah, just even to serve on certain boards, you have to sign a conflict of interest statement to sort of make transparent, you know, if you have a conflict of interest decision that you would benefit from financially, you have to disclose that or refrain from voting on that issue. But when you run for public office, generally speaking, some type of biography of the person's background and some of the details of their former employment, et cetera, should be a part of that whole process. I know as county commissioners, most of us have a bio on the website for the county, and it details for you to a degree previous employment, not a dollar amount of how much you were making, but at least the experience you might have shared. And in my case, I was retired, and so I was, you know, receiving a couple of checks from the government, and the little money they gave me as a county commissioner, let me think back, it was like $1,600 a month. I couldn't live off of that. So I was working on seven boards as a county representative, but I was not relying on those funds to sustain my family by any stretch of the imagination. So it's good to know those things, but I think the greatest detail you would know is what is their background in terms of employment, so you can sort of research that a little bit yourselves. You won't be able to see the paychecks, but you'll be able to see, you know, generally speaking, what the primary resources are or have been historically. Most of the people that I work with, they've either been retired. Very few have been fully engaged in kind of employment, trying to run for sometimes elected position. One young lady did that, but she sort of paid the price because she couldn't show up for meetings. Didn't realize the kind of time commitment you have to give to be an elected official. It requires a lot of meetings for young, which you see on Zoom or on those public meetings. A lot more goes on discussions related to that position than just the public meetings themselves.
So did that answer your question, Emma Talon?
Yes, it did. It gave me some direction. And also, I guess my concern somewhat remains, how are these people, especially younger people, unretired people, you know, how they are supported. But, yes, you did help me out in terms of this, a lot of these things are to be revealed, but it sounds like, as Mrs. Cheryl was saying, that it actually doesn't have to be revealed 100% as to where they're being supported. But anyway, I know you have some other things to finish before the end of the program, but, yes, that was good feedback that you gave me. Thank you.
Sister Amzala, let me just say really quick. Yeah, I still work. I still work full time. I'm about 20 years before I can retire. But I agree with you. It is difficult. And as brother Fleming said, I just happen to have an employer who I told when I was hired, they, you know, I'm an elected official. I have to go to meetings. You know, so we worked that out. So it is difficult if you are still in your working years and you have to go to these meetings, but, you know, I pay my mortgage. And so, you know, they're part of the deal. And unless somebody's going to volunteer to pay my mortgage and my children's school and tuition and everything else, this part of the deal. So, and this is what but I do let younger people know, if you're going to run for office, you got to run knowing that whatever stipend you get, if you get a stipend even, is not going to be enough. So either plan to work or plan to have a consulting job and plan to just be honest with your employer. This is what, you know, it is what it is, and plan to be able to take that time or negotiate with your employer so that they know. Just be upfront and honest about it and work it out.
Unless the person is a very moral person, may be tempting to accept some type of compensation from, you know, from some other people that have interest in what that particular position could be able to benefit their organization, their corporation or whatever. Okay, well, thank you very much again for your feedback.
Sure. Let me say one 10-second response to add to the comments here. You really need to have a good treasurer who will record any funds that come to your campaign, and the source of those funds and how those funds have been distributed is very critical. And that will somewhat protect you from, let's say, questionable people coming to you for favors, because it's got to be recorded officially. You file those reports on a regular basis with your county board of elections. And anyone who wants to check out where the sources come from, for any elected official, it's public information. Just go to the website of the county board of elections and put it right down. You can see where the money comes from. But get you a good, thorough, accountable treasurer to keep you out of trouble. All right, that's enough of that.
That's true. Or just not take money at all.
Yeah.
Is my rule. take any.
Don't, you don't want to end up in a jumpsuit.
No, you
jumpsuit.
Don't.
No.
No color.
One quick thing I wanted to just throw out there. It is related to the whole campaign finance kind of thing. There was a report from so on this Substack social platform, a publication called Popular Information. A reporter there, Judd Legum, identified 50 corporations, mainstream corporations, AT&T among the top corporate donors to election denying officials. So there are elected officials who are still saying that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. Okay? These people are elected officials still holding their positions. And part of your AT&T bill is going to pay for these PAC donations to the elected officials who are election deniers. There are 170 election denying officials. They've identified 109 in federal positions, 11 in state positions. And these 50 corporations have donated $23 million to election deniers. That's scary, folks. That is scary when you consider that people who are elected officials are saying that an election was rigged. Does that mean that you shouldn't be in office, but your election was fine? It was just that presidential one that robbed 45 of being reelected. So there's a lot of money in this politics game. 109 federal elected officials are election deniers, and they have received money from 50 of the businesses, AT&T, UPS, Walmart, Coke industry. So this is the money that's all messed up in this politics game. Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, he got $10,000. His leadership PAC, got $5,000. Attorney General Ken Paxton of Texas, a Republican, he got $10,000. These are just some of the people that they named. So, as Sister Cheryl said earlier, it's not by happenstance that you see so few of the African American and Latino community having representation on the federal level and even on the state level. The money does not come in for those campaigns. And there are some right now for the 2024 election who are being targeted by AIPAC. I'm going to give my little spiel on AIPAC again. Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Jamal Bowman, Ayanna Pressley, and others. It's about five more of them who are part of the Progressive Caucus that are targeted. Millions and millions of dollars have flowed to try and not get those people reelected. And on the other end, you got money flowing in to get people who deny the integrity of the whole election process to be
in office to be to maintain their position. So we got to follow the money. The money is always there, and inshallah. We're going to continue to look at this, the next broadcast. I hope to go more on into the budget process for the United States, so that the next time when the Republicans start kicking the can down the road for these continuing resolutions, we'll all be up on it and know what they're doing. We have 4 minutes. Brother Fleming, we'll let you give your closing comments. Thank you, Sister Amitala from Wisconsin, for your question and comment. And we want to encourage all those who listen to us regularly, please. On Mondays, we're here, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Brother Fleming, your closing remarks, and then Sister Cheryl will close us out.
Well, thank you again for a very informative presentation. I hope that the believers are really listening, and those who are not believers are really listening as well, so that we can be informed, be engaged, and be motivated to make a difference in your local communities. I know that some people miss following the money in their analysis of what's really going on politically, but it's very critical that you really keep up with where the dollars flow. And sometimes we sort of miss the mark on what is the source of funds for government, period, even starting with your local government. Most of that funding comes from property taxes, the biggest chunk, city government or county government. That's the biggest source of funds to operate that locality is property taxes. So if you don't have a strong property tax base, it's reflected in your school budget. And your county commissioners, they have a specific charge statutorily. One of them is to support your community colleges with those dollars, your public school system with those dollars, your sheriff's department with those dollars, your Department of Social Service with those dollars, the public health department with those dollars, public libraries, and a number of different nonprofit entities like senior services, et cetera, come from that same tax base. That's the biggest chunk. So you really have to sort of keep up with how those dollars flow to see how your government really, really works. And go to a meeting. I've had too many people come to me and say, oh, I'd like to run. I said, have you been to a county commissioner's meeting ever just to see what's really going on in these meetings, to get a sense anyway of how decisions were made, what they're discussing, what their priorities are? Because by listening to them, they'll tell you what their priorities are and the way they vote, how they cast their vote. So please know what you're talking about. And Sister Cheryl said earlier, ask yourself a simple question, why do I want to run? And am I qualified at this point in my life to run? It took me a long time to even cross that desert, you could say. I had people trying to get me to run for a long time. I said, absolutely not. Most politicians are crooks. They tell you one thing and do something else once they get in office. And I had to be convinced. One of my former county commissioners, may Allah bless her soul, County Commissioner Mazel Woodruff, she finally told me, she said, Fleming, listen, I hear you always criticizing. Let me tell you something, son. Don't you got 5 babies in your house to feed? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, who do you think controls the price of bread? Said, well, Marita Baker. No. She said, who controls Marita Baker's regulations? She finally broke it down and said, listen, politicians, women, influence the cost of a slice of bread. You want to feed your babies, you better get involved instead of being so critical. That was the convincing element. And when she passed away, she told people that Flynn would replace me eventually because he's sincere and devoted. And the guy to replace her, Walter Marshall, who used to be the NAACP president, he told them before he passed that I want Fleming to replace me if anything happens to me. And so the law's always in charge, and eventually that did happen. But know that you wanted to follow the money, see where the source of the money comes from. And if any county body says they have something called PECO funds, what that means, they got money left over from the last budget that they need to do something with. And they use that for appropriations for law, pet projects that they have. And each county will be a little different. But look for those reserves. How much are they reserved? Are they required to keep for the next year? It's usually a bunch of dollars in that reserve account. And that sort of concludes my comments right now. Maybe next time we'll talk more about how the budget flows on the county level, the state level, and the federal level, inshallah. And thank you again for listening, brothers and sisters. Stay informed, stay engaged. This is 24. Do more, love more, and listen more to each other, inshallah.
inshallah. Sister Cheryl, the time is gone, but go ahead and sign us out.
All right. You change what you see. What you see changes. Madam, you want to thank everybody?
Thank you all for thank you all for your participation. Thank you, Brother Fleming, Sister Cheryl, Sister Amitallah from Wisconsin, up there with the cheese. And thank those who joined us online. And next time, give us some more comments and questions. Thank you, MAP 5, signing out, Muslim American Power 5. Assalamu alaikum and Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Mubarak.